This conversation with the jazz pianist Vijay Iyer was recorded in New York in June 2010. I'm Christopher Lydon, at the piano with the Indian-American musician Vijay Iyer, who has found his way onto the periodic table of jazz, which makes him an elemental figure in the improvisational music of a young century. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude. We call it Vijay Iyer. What is fascinating about you, to me, on CD and with your band at Birdland last night, is this aura that you bring of something beginning, not something winding down or looking back at the end of a century of glory. All I want to know is how you got here at age 38, how you do it, and where you think your music is going, in New York, in Europe, in India, everywhere. What does your compass say?
Wow, those are so many questions. Which one should I answer first?
If there is a zone between Eastern and Western cultures, between Europe and Asia, between the United States and India, and these centuries, it seems to me you live there.
You know, I identify with the culture of cities, and I find cities to be sort of inherently transnational in the kinds of perspectives that they represent. It's often said that New York is not like the rest of this country, and particularly we notice this during election time. But just in general, I think it's just such a hotbed of culture, and there's so much going on here and so many communities represented. I mean, Queens is supposedly the most diverse place in the world per square mile. I think the number of countries represented per square mile. So that kind of pervades the atmosphere here. And that also is, it reflects my own perspective and my own sense of hybridity and the dynamics that kind of unfold in the music I make.
What we know about you going in, Vijay Iyer, is that you're a child of Indian immigrants, grew up in Rochester playing the violin, physics major at Yale, physics PhD at Berkeley.
Almost. I didn't get a PhD in physics. I got a master's in physics, and then I changed tracks and did a different PhD that I was I put together, and it was called Technology and the Arts.
Ah.
But I did actually get a PhD, so continue.
And then taught yourself piano, improvisationally. The question is, how does a physics major go to music, and then how does a musician who wants to hear a new sound leave the string quartets and come to the piano? Big question.
Well, all these things happen in parallel. You know, when you list them, it sounds like this happened and then this happened, but really it all happened at once. I mean, I started violin when I was very young, when I was 3 years old, and I started playing piano by ear when I was five or so, and I just continued doing both of those things throughout my youth. You know, and I took violin lessons until I was 18, and I played a lot of the solo repertoire, and I played in orchestras, and I played in string quartets. At the same time, I was trying to play on the piano everything I heard on the radio, which included Michael Jackson and Prince and The Police and Led Zeppelin and stuff like that. And by the time I was 15, I was starting to get into jazz. I think it was maybe when I was 14 that I really started to jump into that. And that was partly because our school had a jazz ensemble, and they, you know, even though I didn't know anything about the history of the music or the idiom, I was an improviser on the piano. I mean, like, I had learned to play by improvising. You know, there was never any boundary between improvising and playing a song. It was really the same thing for me, because that was how I learned to play, and really that's how we learn to do almost everything, you know.
We
as humans on this planet. I mean, cognition emerges in an improvisational context. I mean, the way we stumble around in the world is that's an improvisation, you know, and that's how we learn where things are and how to navigate around them, and how to recognize them, and how to, you know, it's how we learn from our environment. So that's basically what the piano was for me. It was a very natural thing that just sort of grew as an activity over the course of my youth. And then, you know, I had to kind of buttress it with some theoretical and historical knowledge. So I was exposed to some of that when I was a teenager and just followed my nose. I plundered the library's record collection and then just started playing with people, and things grew little by little.
What was the sound environment of your childhood, including the Carnatic sound that you did or didn't grow up with?
Well, it was there, but I didn't actively listen to it, and I didn't study it at the time. It was around. I'd say that the Indian music that was more a part of my life was the sort of religious music, like the bhajans, which are these kind of, it's like congregational singing. It's something that people do in groups, you know, and non-professionals. They're just religious songs that have a sort of call and response format, and they're very melodic, and they have a groove and so on. Actually, Alice Coltrane has done a bunch of bhajans recorded with a sort of Detroit gospel underpinning to it, because she, you know, founded this ashram in Southern California. So, you know, that was part of the backdrop. The other thing was that we were a new community here in the United States. I mean, the South Asian community only blossomed in the last 40 or so years, and it's partly because of the change in immigration law that happened in the mid-60s that made it possible for people like my parents to come here in the first place. So it was really this kind of like legislative adjustment that gave rise to this whole population, you know. And the impetus behind that was the Cold War, because the U.S. wanted more particularly technically trained, scientifically trained people to advance the U.S.'s technological standing in the world and so on. And that was just part of the arms race and the whole keeping up with the Russians kind of thing. So I think that that's part of the historical backdrop to our community's existence, period, as Indian Americans. But what I was going to say is, because we were so new, everything was really, again, an improvisation. I mean, it was really, in terms of how to express culture amongst ourselves, you know, to what extent to recreate and celebrate, and to what extent to adapt and move away from the past. So, and I find that particularly in the generation of my parents and then of their children, people like me, you find a huge amount of variation in how people navigated that situation. So some were very adaptive, others were very conservative, and they became, in a way, more conservative and more traditional than they were in their homelands, you know. That's part of the inherent improvisation that diaspora is, I think, that you get those, that variety of expression in just identity and culture and things like that. So I'd say that my parents were more on the, they were just not very conservative people. You know, they left home and they came here to do something new. They were pretty young. I mean, my mother was 22 when she came here or something. My father was 9 years older. But they came here for opportunities. So I didn't find them to be very traditional in the sense of like forcing Hinduism down our throats or anything like that. I'm talking about me and my sister. But on the other hand, they did mainly socialize with other Indian immigrant families. So most of our social network as a family was in this burgeoning Indian community in Rochester, New York. So in a way, that was where my Indianness kind of existed, was in these kinds of, with family and with family friends, you know. But then in my neighborhood or in my school, Indianness was more a mark of difference and something that had to be negotiated, you know. So there was this kind of dual existence, I'd say, which is, it's reminiscent of Du Bois's double consciousness kind of thing. And actually, Vijay Prashad, who's this professor and activist at Trinity College in Connecticut, he wrote a book called The Karma of Brown Folk, which is about, it's sort of like riffing on Du Bois' Souls of Black Folk, but specifically addressing how that sensibility exists in our community in a transformed way.
Hmm. And then there's the American sound that you're picking up, both pop but also the formal jazz tradition. Where, how did that happen? And where did you land in that world?
Well, pop music is hard to escape, honestly. It's just everywhere you go. Even in the 70s and 80s, it was, I mean, you know, we listened to the radio. I remember my sister, like, the first record she bought was Saturday Night Fever or something like that. And I remember, like, as a party favor, I got the 45 of Electric Avenue by Eddie Grant at a birthday party. That was one of my first records. You know, so I was into rock and pop, and I was trying to play what was on the radio. You know, because I was in the suburbs, it included a lot of classic rock, as they call it, which, you know, like I mentioned Zeppelin and Genesis and stuff like that. I remember it was like Thriller and Purple Rain were two landmark kind of occurrences in my youth, you know, when those two things came out. It was like my friends and I in the neighborhood were just listening to them both all the time. We'd shoot baskets and we'd have some like boombox with a cassette and it'd just be on loop, you know, we'd just be playing it on. So that was sort of what our summers were like. And I remember being really amazed by Prince because he was playing all the instruments, or he was able to play all the instruments, and he was like kind of constructing all the music himself. And so there was this like deep musicianship. It wasn't just showmanship. It was really like he knew he was a composer, you know. By that time, I had already had, you know, a number of years of musical training. And, you know, so when I was 12, I'd already been playing for 8 or 9 years. So I appreciated instances of musical prowess. And so that kind of, I just started getting into what he was doing, and that led to me checking out a lot of other music in that vein. And then when I was in ninth grade, I think I joined a rock band, and we started playing a lot of crap, basically. but it was fun. And that was a place where I could kind of express myself. That was very different from playing in the orchestra or in anything like that, or learning a concerto or something. So I was playing keyboards. And then the jazz ensemble at school let me hang around and let me play. So, well, I think I had two or three lessons with this guy named Andy Calabrese, who's still in Rochester, a great piano player. And he just showed me a couple of things like this. You know, like things like that. You know, all these different ways of voicing, as they call them, how to voice these harmonic progressions in that sort of idiomatic jazz way. And then he loaned me a few records. One of them was a Keith Jarrett Trio album. Another was a Red Garland Trio album. And those two were such polar opposites to me. I'm like, this is the same music. I somehow triangulated to Herbie. Well, part of it was like Herbie was a superstar already. Rocket was my first exposure to Herbie Hancock. And, you know, and then I started checking out more of his records in the library, and I was like, this is the same guy? This Empyrean Isles and Rocket. That's the same person. So, and then from that, I checked out Miles, and that led me to Monk somehow. And all this stuff was mysterious to me, like, especially when I finally got to Monk. You know, having heard some of this more florid modern stuff, or I mean, when I say modern, I mean historically, like closer to my era, because Monk to me is more modern than anything else. But, you know, going from something as, in my opinion, over the top as Keith Jarrett, and then going from that to Monk, which has all these, like, voids in the music where he's not playing, and or when he does play, he's barely playing. It's like he's just kind of, you know, he's hitting two notes at once or something, or playing these little spare phrases and these, like, crystalline nuggets of music. Stuff like this. Stuff like that, real clusters, or stuff like this. You know, these, that's a song? What is that? these kinds of, to me, they were sort of like these radical interventions on music. It was like reinvention to me. It's sort of like he took the same ingredients and made something so radically different that it really just shook up my notion of what music is.
Mm.
That became the sort of experience that I really wanted to keep having. You know, what more is there that does that to me? That gives me that same sensation of complete, I don't know, like it's like opening a door into another world, you know.
Mm.
You know, and so Monk became my main man, and still is, since then. You know, what is it, 20-something years later?
More. One of the group with us at Birdland last night heard a lot of Monk there. I kept hearing Bud Powell, especially in the separation of hands and that very, very busy right hand. Doesn't move as fast as Bud Powell's does in many ways.
Nobody's does. but thank you, I'm honored by that comparison, and you know, Bud was someone I found myself going back to a lot and developing some of the stuff I'm working on. I started dealing with Bud Powell in depth probably in the mid-90s. And it was partly because, you know, when I was working with Steve Coleman in the mid-90s and later, he said, you need to work on your feel, which it was true. I mean, I didn't really have a notion of what that even was. So, you know, it was partly, you know, like when you're trying to play, how do you play fast and not sound fast? Not sound like you're racing to catch up, or not sound like a total mad scramble. So, and Bud was able to play fast and sound relaxed, you know. I don't know if I can do that, but there's a piece of mine from Panoptic Modes from 10 years ago. That was the first album I released after I came to New York. There's a song on there called Configurations, and I remember, you know, the way I've often worked is that I'll write a piece of music that is beyond me in terms of how to really achieve it. I have to really work with it for a long time to kind of crack it open and to attain a certain sense of poise within it. So this was one of those tunes, and in a way, I had a certain kind of breakthrough I felt when working on it back then. Well, let's see, because I... Thank you. Anyway, that's the thematic stuff, but the sort of thing I did in the middle.
Thank you, Vijay. Go ahead.
The thing I did in the middle was kind of like just trying to navigate the form of it. And it has some rhythmic intricacy, but in a way, the point is not just to be able to play in 21, which is a 21 beat, or it's 3/7 beat cycles, but to do it with a certain kind of expressiveness and to somehow have a relationship to the beat, not just to barely make it, but to actually be able to express yourself with it. So that's kind of, and I don't even, this is like, I'm kind of cracking the seal on it after so many years of not playing this tune, but that's sort of the idea anyway. And it's not, so like Bud became an important point of reference for me for just kind of achieving a certain grace in the midst of fire.
Can I presume to say I hear the spirit of Bud Powell in that piece, but I also want to digress and ask something personal. You're playing oftentimes now with a young drummer, Marcus Gilmore, whose grandfather played with Bud Powell on some of those historic Genius of Bud Powell recordings, 1949 with Sonny Rollins and others. And I hear that same, holy moly, let's make something new. A spirit. And I wonder how it travels. Do you ever talk about it with Marcus or his grandpa and the ghost of Bud? I mean, is there a community out there on the edge?
The elders that I apprenticed with were people on the edge already. You know, and I'm talking about Steve Coleman, who's 15 years older than I am, and Roscoe Mitchell, and Wadada Leo Smith, and Amiri Baraka. These guys are pioneers, every single one of them. That sensibility became normal to me because the people I was learning from are those kinds of people. In other words, they aren't journeyman players. They're actually conceptualists and innovators as well as virtuosic instrumentalists. But what, you know, one thing that's been great about working with Marcus is that, see, because he plays with everybody. I mean, he plays with Steve Coleman. He plays with me. He plays with Gonzalo. He plays with Nicholas Payton. He's done gigs with Chick Corea and with Cassandra Wilson. And, with, you know, basically, you name it, he's played with the kind of leading lights of this music. You know, people who have been innovators, people who have been mainstream stylists, people, you know, on the fringe and people in the center. And he played with Clark Terry, too. So, you know, so one thing that's great to be able to stress, and I think Marcus helps me do that, is the continuity with the tradition. Because it's often it became easy to view me if you didn't know where I was coming from and didn't know, like, how I came into the music and stuff, to see me as an outsider coming into the picture. But I was born and raised here just like so many other people who've been part of this music. And I apprenticed with elders, and I learned from the recordings and, you know, from Monk and Coltrane and Bud and Bird. I mean, like, that's how you learn how to play this music. So at some level, I'm really, it helps kind of overcome that. Well, it's a bias in the sense that there's an assumption that I have more to learn than somebody else to play this music. When really I'm...
Because you look Indian?
Because I have this other heritage. And that heritage is a very important part of who I am, and it's an important part of my music. But I've been here as long as anybody else my age. Because I was born and raised here and surrounded 100% immersed in American culture. So to me, it was never a question of how American I was. But to others, it's always a question. So I find that being able to assert within the music this continuity with the heritage of American music and jazz in particular has been an important part of articulating my identity, you know. So I very grateful to Marcus for helping me accomplish that. And we talk about it all the time, about the, we both read that Monk book by Robin Kelly, and, you know,
yes,
and keep trying to triangulate his grandfather's place in all of this. And you know, he has all these stories from, he grew up around all these guys, of course, not just Mr. Haynes, but they'd all, you know, all the drummers would go hang out and have barbecues in Roy's backyard. You know, so, like, Lewis Hayes and, Philly Joe and Jimmy Cobb and so on, like, all these guys, Art Taylor. Those who overlap with Marcus's still brief life so far came to know him from the beginning. And
the case of Roy Haynes especially, the tradition is one of, in his case, of thinking himself consciously, I'm sure since he was a child, as an artist, as something new.
I get the sense that he just went right down the middle in a lot of ways. I mean, he always was sure of who he was, and still, you know, and that he was able to apply that to so many different contexts and just make the music better. I mean, early this, was it this year? They had this marathon, WKCR, of hundreds of hours of recorded of Roy Haynes on record, you know, and they went in more or less historical order, and it lasted 10 days solid, like they didn't take a break, and that was only a small fraction of what he'd recorded. And it was, you know, the amount of ground that he covered and the variety and the depth and power of it all was just stunning. I mean, you know, it'd be Rahsaan Roland Kirk, and then it'd be Gary Burton, and then it'd be, you know, it'd be Train, and then it'd be
Sarah
Chick,
Vaughan.
And it'd be Sarah Vaughan, and it'd be Pat Metheny. Like, usually when these artists are talked about without mentioning Roy Haynes, they're spoken about as if they're as far apart as possible, that they have nothing to do with each other. But Mr. Haynes, somehow, you know, this is why when you mentioned that periodic table of jazz, this thing that somebody concocted recently, where I seem to occupy the place usually occupied by Einsteinium, which is a very volatile substance, apparently, with
a new element,
short half-life. But what I was noticing is that there weren't enough drummers on this periodic table, because the drummers are the real history of the music, because that the rhythm, it's where the music lives and grows. And that's where all the innovation happens.
On that periodic table, Art Tatum presides in a certain way, but the table includes Bill Evans and Wynton Kelly and Herbie Hancock, Chick Corea, the whole thing. Where does a youngster like you sort of look back, and what are you drawn from that incredibly varied legacy?
Well, I listen to all of it. I listen to as much as I can of every kind of music. I mean, I have to say that the pianists that I am most influenced by are, I'll put it this way, when I have a lot of students through NYU and the New School and different places, and they're, you know, they're usually kind of in a jazz conservatory kind of frame of mind, and they gravitate to the players who have a, the ones who are burning or killing or whatever they like to say, you know, like the ones who are demonstrably virtuosic. But the ones that I always gravitated towards were the people like Monk and Andrew Hill and Randy Weston and Duke Ellington and Sun Ra. And these were more constructivists, I guess, in a way that they're composer pianists. And in a way, the composer orientation is first. And the playerly orientation is an outgrowth of that, of the first. It's a facet of the larger composerly sensibility. So playing is a way to make the music sound a certain way. And it's not about you demonstrating or wiping the floor with everybody. It's about you making the music sound a certain way. So that's just a different approach to the instrument and to music. So I find myself more into those kinds of players than I am into the, you know, as much as I admire Chick and Keith and Herbie and so on, and those guys are incredible. I mean, they're all incredible musicians, and I feel utterly dwarfed by them whenever I hear them. But I find that my just aesthetically, I vibrate more with the Randy Westons and the Herbie Nichols.
And what about Count Basie, who we don't think of as a composer, but we surely think of him as the creator of spaces, sound, the voice of an orchestra?
Yeah, that was like, he was a real radical with the piano, you know. And it was, in a way, it was like he found a solution to how to function in that juggernaut of an ensemble, you know, like what can a piano player do to stand up against those forces, just like, you know, just in terms of sheer volume and density. Well, what can you do? Do the opposite, you know, to play, you know, find your space, find your moment, and drop in just enough.
One note, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. So, but Basie himself was an incredible pianist. I mean, man. Especially because he kept so much of that in reserve. And then when you'd hear him unleash it in a solo context, for example, you realize to what extent the big band is a version of him at the piano. And then him at the piano in the big band is so different from him alone in that sense that he's just doing only what's necessary. And but because that ensemble had so much motion and momentum and bounce, you know, there was a, well, in a way, like Monk has a similar sensibility in that once things were set in motion, he'd often step out for a minute and let the music persist without him, because his work was done for that moment, you know. And then when he'd come back in, it'd be a huge event in the music.
Vijay, come to the music we heard last night. People hear on your new CD, Historicity, tunes by Stevie Wonder, Leonard Bernstein. Last night we heard, I think, Duke Ellington and Sophisticated Lady, a lot of it.
Oh, no, that actually, there's a piece of mine that has some descending chords that seem to remind people of Sophisticated Lady.
Let's hear them.
Well, this is this. That's part of it. So there is a Ellingtonian, Strayhornian kind of palette. That's one of the first tunes I ever, or one of the first ballads I ever wrote back in the early 90s or something. And I started bringing it back. It's called Our Lives.
Describe, though, what you're doing with those elements, including that Stevie Wonder Big Brother.
Well, you know, I had the idea to play that to put that on the album just basically the day before we made the album. But I, you know, it's a song that I have listened to so much, especially for whatever reason in the last 5 years. Partly because when my daughter was born, we started listening. I think we had already been listening to that era of Stevie Wonder. I'm talking about Inner Visions and Talking Book and those albums.
Isn't She Lovely?
Yeah.
For his daughter, right?
Right, exactly. But what I found is that there's just so much love in the music of Stevie Wonder that it becomes a good thing to have around, to have playing in the house when you have a new member of family, you know, when you have a child, a newborn, or have a baby in the house. It's sort of a, it's this nurturing and warm sound, and very alive and soulful, you know. So we listen to a lot of him and a lot of Nina Simone. In fact, my daughter's middle name is Nina, after Nina Simone. So, you know, this music was on my mind. One aspect of that song that's so crucial is it's a protest song. You know, it has this deep irony in it, because it's a joyous sounding song about some very tragic circumstances. So that makes it, in a way, really a powerful text to try to unpack as performers and as improvisers, because there's so much in it. You know, it has this huge range of this huge range of feeling in it, this defiance.
Can you show us what you do with the rephrasing of the song Somewhere from West Side Story?
You know, I was trying to play it by myself the other day, because it's kind of complicated, because it sort of has two different... Yeah, it's sort of two different meters at the same time. You could, or there's one implied meter, but there's another actual meter. So it's like... That's hard to do. You know, that song is so overdetermined at this point. You've heard it a million times, and I dare say that everyone in that room last night knew that song. I think one thing I wanted to do with that version was kind of slice it up and see what else we could make out of its components, you know. So... And also, you know, often when I do a cover, I do it from memory. So I don't really resort to the sheet music. I'm just thinking more about... I really want to think about how these songs work on our memory. And so one way to start to do that is to just rummage around in my own memory. And so often there's a kind of imperfection to it. Like when I did this version of Imagine, the John Lennon song, on an album in 2005 called Reimagining. That was another... I mean, I did a similar thing in the sense that I reconfigured it and gave it a very different tone and rhythm, and changed the harmonies and stuff. But I realized I left out a part of the song. I realized after it was on the album, I'm like, oh, wait, I didn't do that other line in the chorus.
Sorry about that, John.
Yeah, so then, you know, in subsequent performances, I added it back in. But anyway, it was just sort of an abbreviated.
Do you want to play the missing section for people who wondered where it went?
Yeah, well, okay, so this is the way it... I think it's in there. The sensibility's in there, I hope.
Listening to you last night with Justin Brown on drums and Stefan Krump on the bass, so much of it seemed to be driven by a rhythmic, I don't want to say competition, but shall we say conversation, and then by some deep rhythmic concept. I don't know how you work so closely with a drummer. That was a spectacle. But what is the rhythmic project?
The basic project is I wish I was a drummer. And so I just try to connect with the drummer and do what the drummer does. I find that when you link with the drummer, everything sounds better. Just when there, you get that sort of resonance, that sympathetic action happening that... That's part of what music is the sound of people moving together, you know. When I put music together, I compose with the drums, you know. I write drum parts that are notated. Because what I find is that when you don't do that, your music sounds like everybody else's music, no matter what. If you just let people... reach into the standard bag of tricks, then it's just going to sound like more of the same music. And one thing that Steve Coleman told me long ago, which is very demonstrably true, is that what always pushes the music forward is a change in the rhythmic basis of the music, you know.
It changed every 8 bars last night with Justin Brown, it seemed.
Oh, well, that's a lot about what he brings to it and what he brings to the table. I mean, because that's the other piece of it, is that the parts I write are sort of skeletons, you know, and then it's up to the player to flesh it out. But, the sensibility comes from the history of the rhythm section. You know, if you listen to James Brown's music, you could just play all those classic tunes one after the other, you know, Sex Machine and I Feel Good and so on, you know, Hot Pants, all those like classic jams that, you know, the hip hop group sampled 1,000 times and so on. Every single one is different. The drum parts are different, the bass parts are different. I mean, you could say that, yeah, they're all in 4/4 and they're all funky and they have a backbeat, but that's not the whole story, because you have to look at the exact particulars of how they're put together. Every single one is different. I mean, you could sit down and play the drum part for one and you'd know that's what song it is. And you could play another drum part and say, oh, that's not the same song, it's a different song. So he composed for the drum set too. You know, so this is not a new thing. And you know, when you listen to pop music, so much care is put into what the drums sound like and exactly when they are playing and what they're playing when, you know. So it's So you can't resort to anything generic when you're putting music together. You have to really care about the specifics like that. And that's what makes the music sound the way it does.
You remind me, we had this conversation once with Roy Haynes and Danilo Perez on the radio. Roy, a very lyrical, melodic sort of drummer, and Danilo, a very percussive, rhythmic, Latin sort of pianist. But the question was, you know, what is the pianist saying to the drummer? And what's the drummer saying back? I'm not sure we answered the question. What were you and Justin saying to each other last night?
Well, there's, in a way, a dynamic of synchronous motion, and then it's at times it's opposite. You know, like we land together at times, and we kind of move apart from each other at times. And so there's it's tension and release is what it is. You know, and you heard it in Coltrane's group too. Like in this classic quartet, you'd hear them sort of creating more and more tension over a longer and longer period, and then suddenly it would all land together and it'd be this glorious resolution, you know. So it's basically the rhythmic version of what in Western harmony is called tension and release, but I think it's and with rhythm it's an older concept, really. It's ancient.
But you all knew last night how to bring both the music and the audience to a sort of boil.
If that is indeed true, it's only because I've been fortunate to get to play in front of people a lot. And so I've, you know, and I care about taking people on a journey. It's not just running through a list of tunes. It's about balancing the opposite forces in the music. So we don't really plan the set list at all. I mean, at this point, we have several albums worth of repertoire to draw from. So really what I do is I come out and kind of assess. It's sort of like you take the temperature of the room, you know, to see what the energy is, and then you offer something, and then that leads. That, you know, part of it is that these tunes can go in so many different ways each time. So you can't say, okay, this is our up number and this is our down number. You know, it's because what was up yesterday might be down today. You know, so you have to really choose at the moment. Okay, and if often I'll find myself sort of thinking ahead, like I'm in the middle of playing a solo and I'm already thinking about what should happen next, like what's the next tune. So you sort of have to act as a composer in real time with all these elements, you know. But I really try to judge based on the current energy, like what will be the best next move to kind of is it something that we need to now heal from? Has there been this like kind of violence? And if so, do we now need to offer something more warm and nurturing and kind of wholesome? <You know?
laughs> I was going to ask you about the colleagueship in the musicians, the jazz musicians of your generation. None of them celebrities. None of them do Rolex watch endorsements.
No, some do.
Not the guys on the bandstand last night.
Oh, no, that's true.
Not that they're anonymous or unworthy either, but it's just that there's an affinity of talent in your generation that strikes me again like earlier jazz of the 40s, jazz of the 20s almost. There's a complete meritocracy about it. People don't get there by endorsement or because their father or their cousin sent them. They get there because they know something which maybe only their colleagues can be sure of. How does it work?
Everybody just ends up playing together a lot in a lot of different contexts. I mean, here in New York, there's a lot of music happening. There are a lot of, I won't say a lot of opportunities to make money, but there are a lot of opportunities to play. And even beyond that, there are people playing together just for fun or for you know, mutual betterment. and that's happening all the time. So you're not going to get into this area of music if you don't love music, because there's no other reason to do it. I mean, it's not a recipe for fame and fortune, you know. People are in it because they love it. And so that love is constantly expressed in sort of wonder at new music and at new possibilities and new discoveries and new talent, new players on the scene who have something new to offer. You know, there's a belief in innovation, and also people cherish the history of the music.
What is it you hear in each other? And I'm thinking of the great variety of people, some I know vaguely, like Mike Ladd, who's a sort of performance artist and writer, or Steve Lehman, who's a ambitious, unorthodox saxophone player. What is it you see and hear in each other?
Well, I think each case is different, but it's usually the potential for building something together, you know, in particular. And at least for me, I'm interested in building music with people, you know, not just in...
What does that mean?
Well, it means that I want somebody to bring something to the table that is not what I'm bringing to the table, so that we can construct something that's larger than any one of us, and also larger than even the sum of it, you know, the proverbial sum of the parts.
Building sounds like architecture, Vijay.
Well, that's a fair metaphor, I think. I mean, it actually, the analogy holds up, because architecture is about creating spaces. Obviously, there's a lot of technical skill involved, but there's also a sense of grace and beauty that you also want to bring to the table. It's not just purely functional, unless you are of the sensibility that functionality is beauty, which some, you know, that's part of the history of architecture, of course. But you know, at any rate, you're creating spaces for people to move around in. That's what we're doing. And you want them to be free, but you also want to offer them things, to offer them possibilities. You want to frame their activities in a way that helps infuse it with meaning.
And it's about the spaces, not the walls or the ceilings or even the foundations, maybe.
You obviously can't have one without the other, but when you get to the heart of the matter, what's the point, right? What's the reason that it's there? The facade of a building is not the reason for a building, right?
I want to ask you about where this music is going, but another digression, if I may. I vaguely connect you with Pico Iyer. I don't know if he's related.
I don't think he is, although I actually don't know.
It's a famous Indian name, right?
Of course. Well, you know, there are a lot of Iyers in the same sense that there are a lot of Cohens. Because, you know, I didn't choose that name at random, but Iyer denotes the sort of like, it means that I'm a Brahmin. I'm a Tamil Brahmin who worships Shiva. That's what that means. So, as you can imagine, there are a lot of us. It's, in some way, it's not a name. It's more like a designation.
I think of Pico Iyer because, not just the name, but because he's our model global citizen. He's the Dalai Lama's friend and kind of writer. But he's also the guy who lived in the Los Angeles International Airport for a season just to observe the human race in transit. And he's out there. He lives in Japan, grew up in England, Indian name, educated in America, but complete world citizen in spirit as well as in fact. And I wonder if you see yourself that way, musically.
Well, to some extent, yes, but I also really, I identify as American, you know, like pretty, it's a very important orienting force for me is my relationship to American culture and to American experience and the struggles of being American, you know, the kind of responsibility that you have and this sort of well, you know, obviously there are 300 million of us, so it's hard to generalize about the American experience, but my particular American experience is one of like I said, improvisation and navigation through a certain set of challenges and opportunities. And it's also about what aspects of American history resonate with you. And you know, for me, as a person of color in America, I've looked to histories of other communities of color in America as a sort of orienting guideline, you know, as exemplars, basically. Mm. And that's part of what led me to really stay with this music. You know, the history of the African-American pioneers who dreamed the impossible and made this music happen.
Role models in particular.
Well, you know, we were talking about Monk, and I think even in this regard, he's a great example. Especially having just read that biography by Robin Kelly, you really get a sense of the struggle, you know?
Amen.
I mean, it's part of that. There's a migration narrative behind his generation, too, you know? You know, one thing that emerges in that book is that where Monk grew up, which was over by Lincoln, what's now Lincoln Center, which was then kind of one of the major African-American neighborhoods in Manhattan, something like two-thirds of the people on his block were from the South, including his family. I mean, his mom, she was a single mother, and she came from, I think it was North Carolina.
Right.
With the three kids so that they could go to high school. Because where they were, it was illegal for black people to go to high school. Right? So she decided to take these three kids, scrub floors for a living so that they could have that opportunity. That kind of sort of striving is the backstory for this music, you know. The struggle to find a place for yourself in the world and to gain a foothold, and just to survive, you know. So that when you talk about improvised music, it's really like, as William Parker says, in order to survive, you know, the music was invented for survival purposes, you know. It was a response to necessity.
Mm.
That's Mujal Richard Abrams defined improvisation as a human response to necessity. I think that's a good way to look at it. Not to match my struggles with theirs, because I had a very different path, you know, and my parents had a very different, they had a very different circumstance. So they were not at all in a struggle like that to just have those kinds of basic things. But they also came here with very little, you know, and had to build something.
You're just back from a substantial tour in Europe. I keep wondering, what are they hearing? And what do they hear in India when they play Vijay Iyer?
Well, we've had very nice responses everywhere we've gone. And it was nice when my group played in India for the first time in 1998 at a festival there called Jazz Yatra. And that was like a certain kind of homecoming.
Mm.
I think it was nice for folks to see their potential countrymen or their cousins or brothers or nephews or whatever playing on stage there. That festival was usually bringing in well-known Americans and Europeans who were not South Asian American to play. So it was sort of like importing, spending Indian money to import these non-Indians and demonstrate what jazz is. So then suddenly there was this notion of connection, like, oh, jazz is us too, you know. And I remember, you know, someone was yelling out, Vijay Bhai, you know, like basically referring to me as their brother, you know, which is nice. So that was a nice feeling. And I had relatives in the audience. I had about 10 cousins and aunts and uncles and my grandfather. And so that was a an incredible experience for me.
Would you play for them?
Well, actually, I think we played that song I played earlier, Configurations, that one. Another thing we played was this a piece I had made that was derived from some Vedic chant, which, you know, the Vedic chant stuff has, it's like very constrained in pitch, so we had some... kind of thing. So that was a piece that I built out of that. So
one more sort of essay question. I'm thinking, if jazz from Louis Armstrong through bebop and after was the sound of the American century at its best, does it make sense to wonder if you're working on the sound of whatever one calls it, a post-American or trans-cultural culture, maybe even an Indian century?
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's like I said, I still identify as American, but sometimes I wonder. I mean, I know that that's not necessarily what people first think when they lay eyes on me or when they read my name or something, or perhaps even when they hear my music. I realize that because of my particular vantage and my particular situation at the nexus of these different streams of culture, and as this, you know, as this new century unfolds, and suddenly someone did this article in Salon.com about how suddenly there are all these Indians on TV, on like network TV. We've never been. I grew up never seeing anybody who looked remotely like me on TV. I mean, can you imagine what that feels like? It's a weird. I never knew any differently, but it's you know, we didn't have Aziz Ansari hosting the MTV Awards. We didn't have you know, Cal Penn. We didn't have you know, or the woman on The Office. Suddenly, there are all these Indians everywhere, and also now apparently there's a new NBC comedy called Outsourced, which is almost all Indian cast. This is sort of a new reality, I think, that really we're not just part of the picture. It's we went from not being at all part of the picture to suddenly being a pretty, in a way, almost disproportionately large part of the picture as far as American culture goes. Because, you know, our population here is about not quite 3 million, so it's less than 1%. But that's a population that's only emerged in the last 40 years, you know? So we went from something in the thousands to a few million in 40 years. That's an explosion. And so I guess at that rate, it's probably going to continue growing, and, you know, we'll continue to impact culture in some way. And I think that, well, you see it happening with China, too, is that the new kind of global role of these nations that were previously kind of invisible in the West, that's changing the way people relate, you know. And suddenly people want to learn about what life is like in India or what life is like in China. They want to learn Chinese. They want to learn Hindi. They want to watch Bollywood movies and so on. And I guess that's partly, it's just economic forces at work. And as, you know, in a way, migration is this dynamic that happens on the surface because of economic forces pushing from all these different directions. So, yeah, I mean, I suppose that perhaps I'm fortunate to be at this moment where it's fashionable to look at and listen to and read stuff by Indians and Indian Americans or Indians in the diaspora. But I realize that might be a fleeting thing, and I'm not going to stop being who I am, you know. So what might be a fad for some is a condition, a lifelong condition for me. So I try to think beyond those kinds of things.
It's such a pleasure, and you've been so generous with your time, with your head, with your thinking, with your music. Vijay, would you take us out, so to speak, with something from your new album called Solo?
Okay. Let's see. What could I play? Well, I'm going to play Human Nature, the Michael Jackson song from Thriller.
McCarthy and Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over till listeners add their two bits in comments on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.